Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/Macro Voices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chen of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we are thrilled to share an interview, which was originally published on April 8, 2016, between Raul Pal, founder of Real Vision, and Edward Bonham Carter, vice chairman of Jupiter Fund Management PLC. Mr. Carter sits for an interview which runs the gamut through the market efficiency of high-frequency trading, the structural deflationary global outlook, the benefits of long-term investments to the overall economy, the wide disparity of demographics between emerging markets and developed markets, and much more. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to take advantage of an exclusive 10% discount on RVTV subscriptions by signing up at realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices.
Edward, well, great to see you. Thank you very much for coming on Real Vision. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background, and then we'll maybe talk about a little about Jupiter as well.
So I'm Raul in my early middle ages, I like to call it. I'm making a prediction about how long I'm going to live for, healthy, hopefully. So after going to Harrow School, I then went to Manchester, started reading economics, but got a bit bored with economics and frustrated that it claimed to be a science. I'm not sure it's a science, social science.
Can't agree more.
And then I went to Schroeder's. I missed the graduate trainee program, so I started as an administrative assistant, which I think was pretty good for my ego. I had to learn about the investment business from the ground up. And I was there, I joined there in 1982, just, little did I know it then, just when the great bull market started, October 82. I think that's coincidence rather than cause. So I was then in Schroeder's for about 9 years. And I joined Electra Investment Trust, which is known for its unquoted private equity investment, but I worked on their small quoted portfolio. And I finally joined Jupiter in 94, July 94. Yeah, so having joined in 86 at Electra, Jupiter in 94 as a UK fund manager.
Right.
And then I became CIO, joint CEO when John Duffield left the company to found Newstar. And then I became sole CEO on the buyout of the company. We bought the business from Commerzbank in June 2007. Atrocious timing, as you know. It shows what fund managers or we know about the market.
Market timing.
Yeah. June the 19th. I remember it well, Raul. And 6 weeks later, depending on when the credit crunch begins, but 6 weeks later, it started getting nasty. So it was quite a searing experience. We then floated the business June 2010. And as you know, we're a bottom-up stock-picking house. Largely, we do have some bonds.
Yeah.
Retail focus, we're about 35 billion funds under management, which makes us reasonably significant in the UK, but tiny in the global context. I think we're a hundredth the size of BlackRock.
Doesn't make you not important.
Maybe. It's all relative.
And you run a number of different funds as an organisation?
Yeah, we've got lots of strategies. I think that the ones that we're really good at, I would say, UK equities. We're mostly long-only, but we've got some long-short funds. But yeah, within the long-only space, it's UK equities, European equities. We're selling quite a lot of our strategic bond strategy, developed my colleague, Ariel Belazel. We're expanding into Europe in terms of client base. We've got a big fund of funds operation. That's long-only. So this is all to the retail investor. Those are our main strategies, but I think we've got over 30 funds in total.
Wow. So, I mean, we get a lot of hedge fund guys here, and I think it's important for people to understand how different participants in the market act, because then only then can you understand what the market's made up of. We've had some endowments. People say, well, these guys, I don't think like them. I thought, well, you don't need to think like them. They're important. And it's the same with the kind of long-only community. Because people don't really understand what that means and how they how you can apply risk management within long only, but it's a whole different mindset and a different thing. Talk me through the kind of long only the strategy and how it works for people.
Well, I mean, in a sense, the long only community obviously has predated the hedge fund world, you know, depending on when you take a view when the hedge fund world starts, you can go back to Livermore if you want. But in terms of the modern hedge fund world, which is now about, I'm guessing, around $3 trillion, whereas the long-only community is much, much bigger. I mean, world stock markets, GDP is about $80 trillion, and world stock markets are probably of that sort of magnitude. Our investors are mostly retail investors, large from the UK, largely advised, so through the independent financial advisor. And so when they allocate to one of our funds or one of our competitor long-only funds, they've already made the asset allocation decision to be in UK equities or European equities, except when they're in our fund of funds business, and we've got four strategies with different sort of risk profiles. So we think about risk in a very different sort of way. We don't look at the short side. Most of our strategies don't have any leverage at all. So we're very much taking the cue from the investor saying, look, we want to be in UK equities or in strategic bonds or in European equities. So the whole allocation is very different. The way we think about risk, just on Jupiter for a second, is very company and credit specific risk. We look at volatility and betas and all that other stuff. But we generally have a view that it's at the corporate company level. And we spend our time trying to analyze companies from the bottom up. We have different styles, so we encourage difference. We don't want people to think the same way. So we don't have a particular value style or growth style. Different managers have different approaches. If you want to look at it from the sort of top down, we're probably mid to large cap, with a slight growth bias in the firm as a whole. But we encourage different views because, you know, a pluribus unum, as the Americans say.
How does hedging work in the long-only strategy? Always the vision is, you know, you're in this for the long run, or you have to market time yourself buying and selling within the funds.
Well, we don't hedge our market exposure. We take it from the client that over the medium term, we mean around 3 to 5 years. Our average client does hold a fund for that length of time, sometimes longer. As you know, it's complicated in the UK. People got capital gains. They may want to roll up their gains for a longer time. So we tend not to hedge market risk because we think that's up to the individual investor.
Yeah.
And we try not to time markets in terms of cash allocations. There's some exceptions to that, but generally, let's say in our fund of funds, if they're nervous about markets, they will look to managers that, for example, may be a bit more defensive in their approach. And when they feel a bit more confident about markets, you may want to go for a more aggressive, growthy manager who might have a bit more speculative style. So that's how the fund of funds team does it. But generally, long only, we're buy and hold merchants. We tend to have quite focused portfolios. By that, I mean 40 to 60 holdings, which in the context of long only investors, that's relatively focused.
Yeah. So the idea is to keep a consistent process regardless of the cycle. So then when retail investors come to you, they know what they're getting, and as you say, it's up to them to decide when they want to get in and out of the equity markets per se.
Yeah, and it's consistent to the manager, so we're not saying that all our managers think in the same way. We might have different managers may have different views on one holding. You know, some might like Shell, for example, and others really dislike it. So we encourage that, and we all sit on one floor in our new building in Victoria and encourage debate, but don't require people to have selected lists on a top-down basis.
I was going to ask you about that. How do you stop groupthink? Because it's really important. If you're trying to build a robust organization with differing views, very few do that because, A, the CIO often dictates view, and just to stop people having this groupthink, how do you do that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. I don't think there's any magic formula, but you hire different people, different backgrounds. The CIO's role, to your point, Stephen Pearson, is coordinating the roles of the different strategies. He's not sitting there saying, I want you to think in a certain way and have this list of stocks. So it's very much a coordinating business role and helping our fund managers, you know, increase the probability of generating alpha. So we encourage different views. You're absolutely right. If the tendency in an organization is people sort of want to agree with each other over time, we avoid committee decision making. I think there's one streak which runs through the organisation role is that we think that committees making decisions are very dangerous because, as you know, in committees, often it's the junior analyst in the corner who might have an interesting view, but they might be shy, or worried about the hierarchy, and people consciously or unconsciously say, you know, I'm the big gorilla in the room and, you know, you be quiet. And that's a really dangerous way of making decisions because, as we know, often investment processes and committees made up of clever people can often just replicate consensus with after the costs of active fund management means the client has an elegant route to underperformance. So discuss things in committees by all means, but don't make decisions there. So we believe, perhaps like the hedge fund community, that some people in the investment world just are more talented. We can have a debate, is it nurture or nature?
Yeah.
But if you accept that philosophy, then what the organization has to do is give them responsibility for their portfolio within confines of risk control and performance accountability. You need to do that as an organization. But if you're the fund manager on strategy, it's up to you within those confines to make your decisions.
Yeah, and that means that the senior management role is their asset allocation is actually people.
Yeah.
It's all about, you know, you need to think, you know, okay, we've got a lot of, you know, growth bias guys within that particular style. We need to bring other people in. So then how do you look for...
Yeah, it's a very good point. So how do you develop an organization?
Yeah.
And some of it's internal development. We've had people, I'd like to think that we have a better record on longevity as fund managers in Jupiter. We do have biases. I personally think, and I think my colleagues share the bias, that it's one of these industries that actually should get better with age, which is great for our early middle-aged people. The key thing is, A, you've still got to be have the appetite to do it,
yeah.
Still have the talent, and want to be stimulated by it. But generally, I think investors do get better with age because it's the old dictum, history doesn't repeat, but it has a habit of rhyming. So to your point, what does senior management do? We're there to support fund managers that we believe in who are underperforming. That's a key point.
Yeah.
You don't want to be turning your fund managers over too much. And there is a tendency of both investors and management to lose faith in good fund managers just at the bottom of their investment style when they're underperforming.
Yeah.
And then you whipsaw investors, as we know.
Yeah.
Having said that, there are times when you have to make changes. We've changed managers in the past, you know, because it hasn't worked out for them
sure.
or for us. And then we make sure, do we have an internal candidate? One of my roles as vice chairman at Jupiter is to look at our talent and bench strength. And if we've got the talent we want to promote internally, I think that's the best, highest quality way because you get a known quantity.
Absolutely,
you know, both the individual knows what the firm's behind and vice versa. Sometimes you can't do that. So recently we brought in Jason Pidcock, who joined us from Newton. We're just launching an Asian income fund. Bit of an advert there. But that illustrates your point. You know, if we find people who want to join what's still a relatively small investment house, which is focused on investment, I think that's very important. And a lot of fund managers say, look, I get all the rules and regulations, but I want to just concentrate on, well, obviously seeing clients, but also creating alpha. Then we're a great environment.
Noticing, you know, my background's hedge funds, and I'm noticing how restricted individual fund managers are within hedge funds nowadays. So Alan Howard being the great example, he runs a very tight ship. He's a good manager of people or his hedge fund assets. What he does is he'll fire people who've been outperforming because he, you know, take profit on your winners.
Yeah.
And, you know, he manages it very tightly. And if I look at now, when the hedge fund business first started, the hedge fund guys had all the movement to be able to make some big bets. They had all the ability to look at things differently. Mm-hmm. And the institutional business was much more restrictive. Mm-hmm. Now, if I look at an organization like yours versus what's happening in the hedge fund industry, those guys can only have, you know, 5% volatility.
Yep.
If they lose X one month, they're out. You know, it's. I think the game is shifting back to, you know, yes, obviously you need to have a market that's trending mm-hmm. upwards in that environment, but you'll get much better returns just by how the structure of it is now.
Yeah, well, I think in a way you're right. I think there is a sort of swing back to the past, if you like, back to the future, if we can use that expression.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a constant challenge in the investment business. I think an interesting philosophical question, why is it we're all living much longer, and yet the time horizons that both investors are being charged actual underlying retail investors think about their world, politicians, the whole caboodle, if you like, and forcing more and more short-term decisions. We try and support a longer-term investment process rather than trading. And I agree with you that if you have artificial stop-outs and where people have to liquidate positions, then I think there's something wrong with that. Now, I think it's partly about trying to educate your own investors. I'm not saying we're perfect. Everyone's got the same sort of challenges. But if you don't use leverage, and the retail investor, to his or her credit, there's a lot of stuff, sometimes rude stuff, said, oh, retail investors don't get it. They always buy at the bottom, sell it. Buy at the top and sell at the bottom, the other way around. But institutions do that as well. So I actually think that retail investors, by and large, do get it, and their behaviors, you know, we've had a number of crises, as you know, since the early 80s, and people are slowly learning that actually they should diversify their investments, they should average, do monthly schemes. This is the retail space.
Yeah.
Reinvest their dividends, absolute key. All this motherhood and apple pie, and people are slowly getting it. It's not perfect. It's not helped by the media. As you know, you get headlines saying 40 billion wiped off shares today. You very rarely get in the last 4 months. You know, things look a bit better. You know, that's ignored because that's boring. It doesn't sell news.
Yeah. How do you get the retail investor to understand how to buy and hold? Because one of the reasons I set up Real Vision was this, is I just think they're woefully underserved by the whole community, the financial community. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys get lots of information. The hedge funds get lots of information. Mm. Family offices do. But the retail, they don't really get any high quality information. So how do they make those time decisions? How do they learn from history?
Yeah, well, it's a good point. I mean, I would start it almost without sounding pretentious. I firmly believe that individual citizens at school, there should be a citizenship course which you learn about. Financial investment should be a component of that. But basic stuff, what is interest? What's compound interest? What does inflation do? How to make rational decisions about your mortgage or your credit card borrowing. And within that, there would be a component on investment. What you need to think about your retirement in a world, as we know, that the individual, whether they like it or not, has to think about their retirement, you know, 20, 30, 40-year view, which, as you say, you need to have a buy and hold strategy. The information point is quite interesting. I have a theory that actually we're all deluged in information. And a lot of the stuff in the professional world, you know, is how do you get, well, it's partly what Real Vision is about, you know, how do you get wisdom as opposed to information?
Yeah.
I think the job of a fund manager in many cases is filtering that information and attributing significance to his or her investment approach. Now, actually, for the average retail investor, I think it's rather like a garden. They shouldn't actually look that often. I don't think it's that helpful, all this short-term volatility in markets or in their portfolios, because what little research, and there is quite a lot of research on behavioral finance, shows that people, it makes them make the wrong decisions because they're responding with, if you like, the fear part or the greed part.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's the worst part of our human nature, when you need to stand back and make rational decisions. So what can the industry do about it? I think, you know, this is a long-term investment game. It's long-term education. I think we try and there are lots of our competitors to try and educate people about rational investment decisions. But it's not easy because we're fighting human nature as well. And it's not just the retail investor. It's all of us. We're all caught up in it.
Yeah.
So the more all of us can do to help, the better the system will be.
So do you necessarily believe that... getting the gist that you're a student of history as well. Do you necessarily believe that equity markets always trend over time?
Do they always
trend higher over time?
Well, my prejudice, I'm what I call a muddle throughist.
Right.
So I think I'm a great, hopefully not a delusionist, naive optimist. I might be that, some might say. But I think it's relatively early on in human development. You know, we've only been allegedly civilized. You can question that.
Yeah, that's for, a big
question. 2,000 years. But let's say that we've come out of, you know, agriculture, you know, started 30,000 years ago, Industrial Revolution, whatever, 18th century in the UK.
Yeah.
And our brain is still effectively similar neurologically to when you and I were running, or our ancestors were running around in the plains. So have we made some giant cook-ups? Yes. Are we going to make more? Absolutely. But also the human being is wonderfully ingenious. and technology. We can have a long debate if you want about technology. You know, some good aspects and bad aspects of that. We're slowly getting our heads around how to manage the modern economy. We're certainly not there. And, you know, the current mess we're in monetary economics and very low interest rates, I think, is yet another challenge. But do I think that GDP and market levels will be higher in 20 or 30 years? There's a forecast for you. We can have another interview in 20 years' time when you're about 50. I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think the world's condemned to a Japanese-like situation of 89 to...
But there again, in the long run, that doesn't make a difference anyway. I mean, one thing I did look is we've got a price data of the UK stock market going back 300 years, I think. So South Sea Bubble, all of that.
Yeah.
And somebody's constructed an index of UK equities over that period of time. And they were very cyclical. They didn't do a lot until the baby boomers arrived in the 50s and 60s. And then
demographic theories.
Yeah. And then that's driven a lot of the demographics. Even if it wasn't demographics, there can be a very extended period of time where the stock market doesn't do anything.
You're quite right. So,
but my stock picking, you can still make money out.
Yeah, you can. So my colleagues get rather bored. So in about 2000, I came up with a new name for the for these sideways markets, as we call it. So we got an animal's name for up market. It's bull market, and for a down market, it's bear. So long time markets go sideways. You're absolutely right. And I call it the hippo market. Why is it the hippo market? Because as you probably know, the hippos act, despite being a herbivore, it's the most dangerous animal in Africa. It kills more people. And the reason is because people underestimate it lies around doing nothing in a mud pool for a lot of time and suddenly has bouts of volatility,
yeah,
like you're seeing at the moment, which is extremely dangerous for bystanders. So you're absolutely right. Markets do zigzag. Happens to be the name of our new office building, Zigzag. And you're right, people underestimate. So in real terms, actually, the markets have actually been going down. Well, if you take the FTSE 100, which is imperfect index, but since it hit 7,000, just below 7,000, December the 31st, 2000. It's been going sideways in normal terms, but in real terms, even at low inflation rates, it's been going down.
It's going down.
Yeah. So trending. Yeah. And then you know, you're more expert in the hedge fund world, but it seems to me that there's some very odd momentum strategies and algorithmic trading techniques and high frequency trading, which is having some very interesting
distortion. Yeah, how do your fund managers deal with that? Dealing with there's no liquidity. You can't phone up, you know, in the days of old James Capel and say, can you get me a price in this? Actually, they didn't market make, but Newcourt or something.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't exist anymore, really.
Yeah.
The liquidity is driven by machines that actually front run your order as opposed to trying to help your order.
A somewhat unfashionable view that this liquidity, obsession with liquidity, I think's overemphasized. I think we want markets to be there for investors over the long term rather than people trying to arbitrage on a time microsecond. I don't think, is it abuse of markets is a strong expression, but I think markets are there to allocate capital between, you know, savers and borrowers and between firms according to different methods, and there are different methods of doing it. And having high frequency trading, you know, maybe I'm a traditionalist and viewers are shouting at the screen at the moment. So whether that leads to, should you have gating mechanisms or time gates, I think it's worth looking at.
Yeah.
To your point about liquidity, it can be an issue. I mean, generally for our strategies, you know, total firm size of 35 billion, we're still a very small percentage of most underlying markets. You can get the liquidity you want. I think there is an issue, as I'm sure you talked about, in some of the bond markets of the world.
Yeah, really.
A lot of money has gone into that, as you know. And if markets panic and there's a rush for the exit, I'm sure there'll be issues there. But at least bonds have maturities on them. So even if there has to be gating mechanisms, as long as the underlying security pays it on the redemption date, that's an assumption, then I think that can work it out, unlike equity markets. So I'm sure we're going to have periods of more volatility and issues.
And why do the fund management firms not get together and say, okay, enough of this method? I mean, I understand the banks are restricted in what they can do now.
Yeah.
But there must be a way to say, you know, we need to impose some sort of time gates or to make it a level playing field to allow you actually to do what you do.
Yeah, I mean, they're starting to be resistant. I'm sit on the Long Term Investor Forum, which was set up in the wake of the K review in the UK. under Simon Fraser, who's chairman, to look at particularly, it's more not just the efficiencies of markets, but how to improve the stewardship of fund managers on behalf of their clients, of the underlying companies, and how to improve the engagement. Still very early days, but I think there's some very interesting things there. I mean, your question is, it's quite interesting. It's because fund managers, which I think is a good thing, are naturally competitive. So there's a bit of herding cats of fund managers. And, you know, we can all sit around, you can talk to have a round table. Maybe we should have a round table and discuss some of these issues, and everyone's going to have a slightly different view. So look, that's the nature of markets.
Yeah.
And when there's an issue which you might get agreement on, it's not easy to get. But I think if there's going to be more perception that markets are sort of volatile, partly because of high frequency trading, then there might be more of a resistance to it. At the moment, I think it's manageable. Yeah. And volatility, you know, fund managers complain about volatility, you know, it should be an opportunity for them. If the there's more statistical occurrence of mispricing from a fund manager's point of view, well, subject to volumes, then they should take advantage of that.
Because it's interesting, again, I mean, I know we're talking a lot about the difference between the kind of traditional fund management and hedge funds. Hedge funds are supposed to capture volatility. That's their job. But actually what happens is they shrink risk because of how their risk management models are constructed. Exactly. Well, traditional fund managers not necessarily have to do anything with volatility, or if not, if they do have some cash, they're always, therefore, the net buyer and the opportunity that comes. And I think, again, there's a, I love the fact when whole ideas get misconstrued and the kind of traditional fund management industry gets terribly misconstrued because people now think it's hedge funds. And again, I'm just looking across the landscape thinking, you know, who actually is a better steward of assets over time now? Everything's changed.
Well, you know I'm biased.
Obviously.
I mean, I think it's the usual thing. It's the curate's egg. I think there's some really good fund managers in the hedge fund community who tend to have a longer term. I'm biased towards the long term, as you could probably gather.
Yeah.
And there's some really good guys in the hedge fund world, just as there's some dodgy people in the long-only world, dodgy in the sense that they're closet indexer and not delivering value to their clients for money. Is there an issue, to your point, that the risk controls in strategies in the hedge fund world, and maybe in the long run as well, can produce perverse outcomes? Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that.
So talking of perverse outcomes, we live in a pretty weird world right now. How are you looking at the current situation? I mean, there's so much going on, it's almost difficult to know where to dip your toe in. But, you know, monetary policy.
I mean, One of the few things I've learned, Ryle, if I've learned anything since joining the city in October 82, way before you, such an old man, is the difficulty of forecasting. And I think a number of your speakers have brought that out in Real Vision. And one of the lessons I say to people who might not be in the investment world is, look, this world is full of people making forecasts, often very credible, you know, statements about the future. And I don't see the world like that. I see it as a sort of series of probabilities. Even then, that assumes you get the probabilities right. My central hunch, which will probably be wrong, is I think we're still in a world for the next 3 to 5 years because of the coincidence of high debt levels, of aging demographics in the West, not completely, but largely true, of because we're fighting the last battle of the last credit crunch of 2008, that this is getting sort of, that's why we're in slightly disinflationary, possibly deflationary conditions. And the monetary tools that you refer to, no one has the playbook, as the Americans would say, or how are we going to deal with this? So who would have predicted? I certainly wouldn't, but who would have predicted, people far cleverer than I am, in 2007-08, that here would we be 8 years later with record low rates, negative rates on, what is it, $6 or $7 trillion of government debt, of growth rates being really hard to get going. So I think we are in a new world. It's cliche. I think we're just going to have lowish nominal growth for a number of years. Then you've got, to borrow the phrase, these two black swans, tails on either side. Yeah. One is the inflationary tail. Will that pick up? I don't think so yet, because at some point all this printing and unintended consequences, I'm a great believer in unintended consequences, will manifest itself in higher inflation. I don't see that yet. The moment we're tackling this sort of deflationary, bubble, if you like. I rather like to see it in boxing. At the moment, there's the left jab of the of the deflation on the economy. At some point, there's going to be a right hook of inflation.
The problem is that right hook is a knockout punch. I'm not an inflationist. I don't think it's coming for a long period of time. But when it comes, when you refinance all your debt at zero, if you have inflation, I mean, it's a total disaster.
Well, of course, it's
Sorry, I was thinking the law of unintended consequences is the magnitude of the bad outcomes when they occur become bigger and bigger and bigger.
I think that's right. I think the urge to try and... So behind this sort of 2008 dealing with a crisis, I think there's an unwillingness to sort of mark to market in the economic wide sense, you know, to get businesses who should be bust out of the system, to clear out capacity for those businesses and maybe individuals who are effectively should actually be bankrupt. I think there's been an unwillingness to do that, to kick the can down the road. And I agree with you. Is that storing up problems? Yeah. And overlaid with this debt problem, you've got the generational divide between the old and the young, between the indebted and the savers. The savers, of course, have been, as you know, their returns have been absolutely suppressed.
Yeah.
How long is it going to continue? I mean, I think we're still in another image. We're still in intensive care. The economic system is still on methadone. The doctors are saying, look, can we take you off the stuff? And every time the patient lurches towards the exit door, they have a relapse and come back in again. And I think this is a big problem. At some point, you're right, there's going to be a huge issue. Now, the inflation deflation thing, of course, if you're a democratically elected politician, actually a bit of inflation suits you, which is why they're desperate to try and get it, because it's a way of transferring the pain from those who borrowed, probably borrowed too much, and they get devalued, as you know. So what's worse? I don't know, 73.4, as you remember, was pretty horrifying. But a deflation where nominal growth actually goes down for a modern economy, that's really nasty, because what do they do? And we're already talking about QE 4, 5, 6.
So where does this end? I mean, look, none of us know. And again, exactly like you, I think of probabilities. Mm. What I do know is that the number of outcomes are very high, because we're off the
number of possibilities,
and the probabilities of all of those are reasonable. So you could say we could have a massive inflation, we can muddle through, we have a massive debt deflation, we can have a debt plaza accord. All of these are actually probable events now.
Oh, it's great forecast. We're going to have all of them.
That's right.
The question is in which order and how severe.
I think that's actually...
Sorry about that. I'll come back and tell you in 5 years.
But I kind of believe that as well. I kind of believe we will get all of them.
We might get all of them. I don't know. We're facing now, you know, issues about further competitive currency devaluations. Talk about Chinese currency going down and being revalued, devalued. That would be a problem. Rise of protectionism, which being mooted by politicians, you always get that. I mean, I think that's a really nasty one, in my view, because I'm a great believer in free trade in the wider sense that overall the globe is a better place for trade. The fact that trade is slowing at the moment is not helpful. So there's some really nasty stuff out there. Behind it all, where's it all going to end? I don't know. As I said earlier, I still think we're in a world where we are muddling through. That shouldn't make one complacent. There's not going to be more crisis. And if you like air pockets, you know, the airliner stuff, you're at 25,000 feet and suddenly you drop down to 18 and it's a rather nasty feeling for the participants in the plane, but you're still flying. We're going to have a bit more of that, I think. I think there's a big issue. There's another interesting conundrum, which is global profits and corporate profits and margins in most sectors, not all, at relatively high levels compared to historical averages, not in every sector. Yet the cost of financing, as we know in real and normal terms, is very, very low.
Yeah.
Certainly in the States, the P's are relatively high, so your cost of equity finance is pretty low. Yet why aren't people investing more? Yeah, they're buying their shares back, and I've got views on that. But generally, the timing on that is pretty bad. And I think that's a conundrum. You know, under normal economic theory, investment should be picking up. If the available profit, and then you get the answers role of, yeah, well, there's no confidence out there, and the future's never been so uncertain. I think, yeah, the future's never been. Look, tribe living in 1939 or in the Cold War, the Cuban crisis, the future's pretty uncertain then.
Yeah, and also I just think of it, you know, there's perverse incentives right now, particularly in America, to buy back shares.
Yeah.
And I think there's, I think it's almost criminal. I think it will be judged as criminal in the end is you, the management issues themselves stock options, then they borrow money and buy back shares to make themselves rich. Now, who actually benefits from that process in the end? Because net-net, the company is ending up converting, giving the equity profit to the managers and converting the balance sheet into debt. I'm like, how's that a good thing?
Yeah, it's not a good thing.
And that's why they're not investing. I mean, they're
that's
making themselves rich,
which
is that the 1% versus the 99 is getting extreme because of
that. Yeah, it is getting extreme. And Andrew Smith has done some interesting work at comparing investment intentions in the States from family and long-term. That's the premise of family-owned businesses who are quoted and quoted business. And I think there's an argument to say that, look, we're a quoted business ourselves at Jupiter, but and share buybacks aren't so much of an issue for different reasons in the UK, tax structures, etc.
Yeah.
But I think there is a case to answer about who benefits longer-term share buybacks. And as you know, if you look at history in the States, the amounts of share buybacks tend to rise as the price level goes up, which is crazy, you know, as we know all know. I think there is a case for companies looking at buybacks when their shares are very cheap, let's say, I know, P's of 8, 9, 10, relative to the risk-adjusted return of the investment they intend to make. But usually that's happening at the bottom of bear markets and management are most scared then and they're least inclined to it then. So human nature still applies.
So I noticed the massive explosion of the private equity world, which is generally debt finance. If I look around the investment landscape, I think in this environment, I don't want to be involved in listed markets. It's actually operating businesses where you actually get paid dividends and actually get a share of the operating income. Why doesn't the fund management industry move into the non-levered private equity space?
Yeah, I think that's...
it'd be incredibly good for the capitalist system for me to be able to build a media business and then sell a part to a long-term investor who holds long-term portfolios and is not trying to rip it apart by stripping it of all its assets.
Yeah. So I think there's a distinction within the unquoted space, which is implicit in your question. One is, at one end, there's the traditional leveraged MBO, what I call financial arbitrage space, where they're buying a company cheaply, leveraging up, and then exiting either through a float or a trade sale. And then there's the unquoted proper venture capital space, which typically there's a deep pool in the States. It's starting in the UK, but from a lower level. And I would agree with you. One effect of technology means that there are quite a lot of companies who are doing as you say, Raoul, who are saying, look, why do we want to float? Let's stay private, become a unicorn if you can get away with a billion valuation. That's great. But there is an issue about expertise. You know, doing venture capital investment, what little I know about it, it's not my central area of expertise. You know, it's a very specialist area. The failure rate is much higher than people think.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be venture capital. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Mittelstand in Germany, privately owned businesses, big. So they've got a lot of family members who probably would like to cash out some of their money, but have a good long-term investor, which is what Berkshire Hathaway have done well at. But very few people in the fund management industry has gone down that route.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great for the capitalist system because it kind of gets away from the listed market side of things and goes back to the long-term investment.
I think you're absolutely right. If we can get there, it's the old Irish joke, but I wouldn't start from here. The issue is a lot of investors, because they think they're long-term, but actually they're relatively short-term and people say, well, I want to invest in an open-ended fund or I want to, going back to your point about liquidity, I want to sell my investments. You can't do that if you're investing in a minority stake in a business. So there has to be a mindset adjustment. I think there's an issue about tax levels of, they're differentially treated, certainly in the UK, between debtors, as you know, more favorably treated relative to equity capital. That's distorted the decision. Maybe we'll see some more in the budget. But do I agree with your premise that equity finance and long-term equity finance will be a good thing for the economy in this country and other economies? Yeah, absolutely. I personally think it's changing slowly.
Yeah.
I think one of the benefits of technology and the entrepreneurial class is I think a lot of younger people are saying, well, actually, let's become a businessman like you and set up my own business rather than working for someone else. It is higher risk, but I think the toleration for risk and maybe failure is rising, which is a good thing. I mean, there is an issue, particularly in the Western European countries, you've gone bankrupt and all the rest of it. Whereas in the States, it's sort of almost a badge of honor. As long as you haven't done anything, criminal or fraudulent, Good thing.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I mean, spending much more time there because I live in the Cayman Islands now. So spending
must
much
be
more
for
time,
the diving.
It is for the diving.
Yeah.
And what I notice is how I think of all times in my career, this is the most entrepreneurial I've ever seen. Everybody is setting up new businesses. Mm. And I think that's net a good thing. And what is also good, I think, I mean, it's probably doesn't sound right for somebody who's been in financial markets all my life, is it's good for it not to be all about financial markets. It's actually about building businesses that create cash flow, that invest in whether it's technology or physical equipment and people. I think it's good.
I would agree with it. I mean, I'd even add to it, I've got a view, which again may be unfashionable, that the financial sector as a whole, particularly in the West and in the Anglo-Saxon economy, has got too big. There's too much capacity, the cost structures are often out of whack with declining revenues. And I think you're going to see, well, you're already seeing it in the broking world, as you know, a reduction in capacity. And I think that's going to wash through, you know, big swathes of the financial industry, where it's the banking world, where you've got the threat of, not the threat, but the existing players, new players coming in, the insurance world, fund management world as well, which is getting, you know, split between low-cost passive strategies and more focus on the active space where we are. I think that's going to continue. Nothing wrong with that. So I think the world, as you're hinting, has been overly financialized.
Yeah.
And a return to, I'm saying it back to Boasters, I don't know exactly, but to encouraging people to start their own businesses, some of whom will fail, but that's a great thing.
Yeah,
great
exactly thing. Right. Nothing interesting is demographics. You know, we were both lucky enough to be part of the demographic wave of the wall of money that came in, particularly by the time the index funds got going and the 401ks in the US in the mid-90s, where it really exploded. And I look around the world, and obviously you've just mentioned about demographics, where people are going to be disinvesting, I guess.
Mm.
But then I look at, there's a whole swathe of the world that is young, just looks like the Western world was in kind of 1960, 1965, somewhere around then, that looks like a huge opportunity. Do you think as an organization, when you're building a business like this, you think, you know what, we need to run funds that are based around Middle East, Africa, India, that kind of thing, because there is a lot of money to come into those assets versus the shrinkage of the other side.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. I'm a great believer in demographics. It's a small issue with demographics. It moves like the pace of a glacier, but it's really powerful. So when you look out to 2100 and looking at UN Central Forecast, which is probably one of the best databases of projections, you know, the world's going to be roughly, depending on the fertility rate, which does change, you know, about 9 billion people. And the bulk of that growth is going to be in the continent of Africa, to your point. I mean, it's extraordinary, the growth. Nigeria, on some forecasts, goes from 175 million today to near 900 million.
Wow.
Becomes the world's third biggest country by per, overtakes the States in 2050, 60. Now, these things can change.
Sure.
Normally, as economies develop, and
the
key thing on a human level is if you reduce child mortality, then people naturally have less children. You then educate women. And then the move to the cities, which is already happening in lots of parts of the world, has a big influence. Because
I just saw Bangladesh. Bangladesh went from let's say, the early 90s, late 80s, a birth rate of 9 per family, has now gone to less than 2.
Yeah, it's great news. So this is a big driver. Within that, as you're hinting, is the aging effect. So I can't remember when, but in 20 or 30 years' time, there are going to be more people in the world aged over 65 than under 14. That has enormous effect, the pig and the python working its way through. So there are going to be demographic effects. We've already got an India fund, very proud of that. An African fund, you know, I think at some point it will make sense. I mean, Africa's got some big issues, big opportunities, big issues.
Yeah.
But you know, there's no reason why they shouldn't in time develop in the way that other countries have. I don't think it's sui generis to itself. I think, you know, once they get education, further education, infrastructure, an improvement in their governance system, some countries are much better than others, then, you know, 30 or 40 years, it'll be. We've got to get it right also, not just morally and ethically. You know, we're talking about migration, huge number of people, not just the Syria issue, which is Middle East, already coming from failed states like Eritrea and Somalia, and even Nigeria is a source of migrants through North Africa. So we've got to get it right. And demographics, I think, is a really interesting thing. Your point about that in the West, does that mean people are sellers of risk assets? I think one of the effects is that people's retirement phase is going to be much longer. So, you know, people's belief that they're going to retire in the 65 or something, I think that's just, it's already starting to change because people, A, realize actually if you want a healthy, fulfilling life and you're lucky enough to be in a job that you enjoy, that's a key point, then why not work longer? Then I suspect the retirement benefits are going to be cut back in either real or nominal terms because the pact, the political pact between the generations is not sustainable. So there's going to be some sort of change of terms. I think that's starting to happen as well because otherwise, you know, all our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they're going to get a bill which is unaffordable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking through. It's very interesting because we talk about this stuff and when I saw my father retire, you see the whole process. So, you know, living a, you know, very nice life, goes to retirement, and his savings suddenly, I think at the time when he, you know, I said, right, just buy bonds and you'll be fine because we'll never see this level again. It's one of the best things.
Yeah, that was clever.
And it was like, there were, I think,
early 80s?
No, unfortunately not. But it was, bonds were at like 6% or something.
Genius.
It was like, fine.
You should get into the investment business.
Yeah. And, but then still with that level of interest, I noticed his spending halved. Now anybody who tries to retire with no bond yield, basically...
Yeah. What do you do?
What do you do? Your spending has to fall by 75, 80%. And that I just can't get my head around that concept. Is what does that do? As you say, it means that people have to stay in the workplace longer or do extra work to top up their income.
Yeah, are they going to get... No, the sums are, you know, pretty mind-boggling. You're right. I mean, as it is, students are faced with arriving into the workforce with debt already. And they've got to save. They're facing unaffordable housing in many countries of the world. I mean, London's obviously a particular bundle, but yep, that's the other cities of similar ilk. And that's a real problem. I don't know what the solution is. I suspect, funnily enough, you've got, particularly today, a situation where a lot of equity yields are yielding far more than government bonds. So it's going back to the late 50s when equities did used to yield far more than bonds before you had the reversed yield gap.
Yeah.
But you have to tolerate some more volatility. So I think for some part of your portfolio, it does make sense, you're talking about asset allocation, for people to hold equities when traditionally you might say, well, I'm 60 or 65, I should be in bonds. Well, that's not going to be realistic. As you say, where's the income? Or you have a capital portfolio subject to the size and you sell a bit each year, so a drawdown. But even then, that makes the assumption you've got enough money to do that. So for your average retail investor, I think, yeah, it's really challenging. And again, going back to your point, do people really get it? I'm not sure they've done the maths. They assume, oh, I'll be able to live on, I'll be able to generate on my savings and income of X. And actually, the figures are much, much lower.
So moving towards the end of our discussion, I'd love to have you back, there's obviously lots we can talk about.
And that's very kind.
What are you thinking, what's the big opportunities in the world that you see right now that people should look at or are missing and the big risks?
Yeah. So an opportunity, I was just chatting to my elder son, who's still young, he's 19 and badgering me about an ISA. And he said, so where would you invest it, Dad? And I said, well, for a young man like you, I think I probably would look at emerging markets now. I think if you've got a long-term view, you know, basically they've got to come right. And I don't mean that I'm predicting they're going to go shooting up, but on a 5, 10, 20-year view, unless emerging markets work, then we're all going to have problems, both as investors and citizens. So I think emerging markets are an interesting place to invest. So I would certainly look at that. I think the risks are definitely much on the, as we were discussing earlier, that if the economies really can't get going and we spend more time looking at variations of these extraordinary monetary measures. I personally have a view that, you know, a bit of well-targeted infrastructure investments where governments can raise the money at historically low rates, they should be able to beat that hurdle. You know, if you have a good infrastructure investment, whether it's, I don't know, roads or electricity generation, you know, in the move to solve or deal with climate change, wherever you are on that curve, I think there's a huge potential of investing in the energy space over the next 20 or 30 years. On the technology question, I'm sort of somewhere in between by saying, you know, are we facing a brave new world where everything will be possible? And then I answer that, you know, we're saying, well, you know, where are the evidence for technology and the productivity figures? Maybe we're mismeasuring it. But I do think that because we're in the midst of a technology change, I think there's some significant things going on there, particularly in the health space, because of the ability of analysing genes and DNA, that's going to produce some enormous benefits in the next 20 or 30 years.
How do you deal with valuation? Because I agree, great opportunities. We know where they're going over time, most likely. But everything's valued at crazy levels. So how as an investor do you do that? Or do you just wait and say, it'll blow up at some point, then buy it?
Well, hence my comment about emerging markets. I think emerging markets, relative to our long history, I think look pretty cheap. Are there going to be more challenges, more currency problems, some blow-ups in some of these countries and sovereign wealth problems? Absolutely. But I think that's largely in the price. Doesn't mean things can't get cheaper, but if you're investing longer term. I think you're absolutely right. Valuations of conventional equities in the West are towards the high. And so it's the old cliche, you have to be careful in stock selection. Every fund manager says that. And there will be better opportunities as well. But you just have to pick your moments. If you're a contrarian investor, I'm not predicting the bottom of the commodity cycle. But, you know, there's been some big retracement in certain sectors. You know, so the growth sectors and the consumer sectors relative to their historical ranges at quite high levels. I think there's a lot of other sectors that look pretty reasonable value now. But, you know, there's big earnings risk in some of them.
I want to ask you about one more thing is gold. Why is the traditional fund management community not that interested in it? Considering gold miners are down like 90% from the highs and...
Should be. There's some specialists. I mean, the problem I think fund managers have is because they sort of viscerally object to it. You know, it's the barbaric reality. Well, you can't value it, can you? How do you value gold? Other than, I think James Grant's got the best definition, that it's you value gold as an inverse of the lack of faith in monetary systems. That's probably as good as it gets. But it still intrigues me. Here we are in a modern, developed economy, $80 trillion or whatever it is, and that we're still relying on a sort of shiny metal as a store of value. And the only possible benefit I can think of it is a psychological thing. It doesn't yield anything. And he has a value that
negative interest rates kind of has a positive yield.
Well, yeah, you're right. You have less cost of holding it because you're not having a loss of income by investing in it compared to something else. You're absolutely right. Are there specialists who invest in gold and as a hedge? I mean, people say, yeah, I'm worried about things. So I'll have a hedge of usually 5 or 10% in gold. Well, if the world really ends, does it give you a hedge? And for those people who say the world is really ending and, you know, go into your ranch and have the food. Well, how do you spend it? You try spending an ingot of gold, and, you know, walking down the street, slicing bits off. So I think there's some practical things with it. I think ultimately gold is a sort of two fingers to the ingenuity of man. It's basically believing this is going to be my store of value. It's probably the way I've been brought up. Do I see in the short term it can have some value if the monetary... If you're one of these people thinking that, you know, paper money is a monetary construct based on belief, then, yeah, I can see the argument. I just think it's, you know, we're better than that as Homo sapiens.
Fabulous. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you on.
Not at all.